Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. What should you do if you have a brilliant business idea but don't have the funds to bring it to life? In today's episode of All About Business, venture capitalist Sasha Kalecki reveals all. Sasha Kalecki is the co-founder of investment firm Creator Ventures, which he started with his cousin, Casper Lee. They have injected millions of dollars into digital tech companies in just 6 short years. Sasha explains how to craft the perfect pitch, how social media is shaping our economy, and how you can use simple AI tools to scale your business quickly. Well, today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Sasha Kalecki, who's traveled to talk to us today from New York. So thank you for making the journey, Sasha. You have a really interesting business that I only sort of partially understand, which I know is growing fast and is making waves. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you to find out more about what you're doing and to get a better understanding of where the future may be headed. I think you're doing a lot in the tech, social media, AI space, and that's of great interest to me, and I know many of our listeners. So your company is called Creator Ventures. You were the co-founder of Creator Ventures with your cousin, Casper Lee. Mm-hmm. You started out in London, and now you're based in New York. You began with a fund, I believe, of $20 million. Explain what you do, please.
So first of all, it's great to be here. We've known each other a very long time, more than 20 years now. So yeah, it's great to be here on the show. Yeah, I mean, Creator Ventures, we're an early stage venture capital fund. We invest usually in the first round of companies, sometimes in the second round, in consumer businesses. So those are companies that were app-based businesses, consumer AI. Sometimes we do physical consumer products, but generally we're focused on consumer technology. And yeah, we try to lead or co-lead rounds. We had a fund one of $20 million. We recently announced a fund two of $45 million. We love what we do and we're going to keep doing it.
So it's going great guns. I mean, obviously your second fund is twice as large. You started out in London. I mean, I've been looking at some of the things that you've invested in, some of these companies. I mean, they're fabulous. I mean, there's Bird Buddy, for instance.
Yeah.
Explain what Bird Buddy does, because I think it creates a picture that is very helpful for people listening.
Bird Buddy is an AI bird feeder, if you can believe that that's a thing.
Well, so, I found it hard to believe that's a thing. So how does an AI bird feeder work? I mean, who thought of this and what's it do?
It's a bird feeder that is kind of has a nice looking birdhouse you can put in your garden, but buried in the birdhouse, which a bird would not be able to tell is there, is a camera. And attached to the camera is an app. And there's some AI happening in the background such that the camera can recognize when a bird comes to feed at the station and takes a video of it. So you on your app can see all the birds that have come to your bird feeder. And you can collect
birds. Or you can just watch them on your phone.
You can watch them on your phone. So you get a notification if a new species comes, or if you want to get notifications every 10 minutes, you can
tell
you.
This is fantastic. I've become a bit of a birder myself, you see. Yeah. So you can see the goldfinch, coming
exactly.
to eat.
Yeah, exactly, and you collect the different birds. The only problem, the biggest issue for the business is squirrels. Because the squirrels come and also sometimes set off the AI. So you have to, I got my mother one and she's filtered out squirrels.
Doesn't like squirrels?
She doesn't. Well, the squirrels, it's really funny.
Annoying. Yeah.
But it's really close up images with a kind of fisheye wide angle lens of like a squirrel's face really kind of zoomed in. So you don't necessarily want that when you're having breakfast. But yeah, the business is actually surprisingly going incredibly well.
I'm not surprised at all. I want one of these.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I watch the birds from afar and I think it's a really, and you can then look at them on your phone when you're on the tube going to work or whatever.
Yeah. And it's like a classic example in venture capital. You have to sometimes invest in companies that don't even sound like that's a real category. If you ask what's the market size of AI bird feeders, before this company was zero, there was basically no market for AI bird feeders. But if you think about the number of people who are interested in birding, which actually is surprisingly a lot, millions around the world.
You say surprisingly, I'm not surprised. It's a fantastic thing to do.
Yeah,
it's
pretty wonderful. Much a lot of people over the age of 50. Surprisingly, if you're under the age of 50.
That's true. The older I've got, the more interested I've become.
That's what I've heard.
So for young people, this is incredible. But for older people, it's perfectly possible.
And then if you multiply the number of people, the millions of people in the world that are interested in birding by, $300, which is the price they end up paying for this bird feeder, you can generate a lot of revenue. You generate a very, very, very big business.
Yeah. And so did you find the entrepreneur who'd set this up, or how did you meet? How did that become a business journey?
Yeah, it's an amazing team. Oh yeah, one ex-Snap engineer. and one marketing guy, yeah, as well as a hard consumer hardware person. So it's a perfect blend. This is what we really like to see, is they combined the marketing, the engineering, and the hardware all into one business of founding team. They're actually based in Slovenia, between Slovenia and the Eastern United States. And yeah, they were just a perfect team for this, and they've executed it superbly.
This is a business that's only become possible really recently, yeah, in terms of its connectivity and technology.
That's something you really want to see in companies. Like, that's a question that's almost become like a truism or something really obvious within, it was almost overstated sometimes within venture capital, but this is why now question, right, which is like, what's the reason why now is the moment for there to be a $1 billion company built? If something's been possible to do for already 30 years and there's no $1 billion companies doing it already, it's probably not a very good idea.
Not for you. I can see the logic of that. So there's another one that I looked on your website. This is on the creator.ventures site, if anyone's interested, which was just called Feels. And I clicked on that, and it was made very clear to me that this was only for people under 30. And it looked like a dating site. And it reminded me, years ago when I worked in advertising, I worked on Club 18 to 30 Holidays, which is all about getting this audience in. And it had the brilliant insight on Feels, your business site, that you only had 628 weeks of your life between 18 and 30. Yeah. And I was saying, I wish I'd thought of that line back in the 1980s when we were trying to get people to go on 18 to 30 holidays. But it seems to be catering for exactly the same audience in a new contemporary way. What does Feels do?
Well, first of all, I'm happily engaged. I'm maybe married by the time this goes out. So I definitely would not be. Well,
congratulations.
Anyway, but I'm actually not
allowed. You're not a customer of Feels, you're an investor.
Yeah, exactly. But, so not a customer. And I'm too old anyway. That's the other thing.
Okay.
But basically, you know, they're the number one Gen Z dating app in France and Germany. And they're starting to expand elsewhere around the world. They've built a pretty good business out of it. But basically, yeah, it's that idea of when you make something exclusive or you make some people feel like only a certain number of people are able to join, it can help with the marketing and make them go viral on TikTok, and it can help. It becomes more emotive when you almost restrict it. But I think what's really good about their business is that, again, the team have done an incredible job making the product fun to use. So it's all video.
I was going to say, because dating apps are not new, are they?
No,
so
dating
this
apps
one's
are not
got something
new.
Different about so this, it, which is all—it's all video. So it's like a TikTok dating.
Exactly, it's TikTok. You scroll through, and it's kind of fun. You have people not just for themselves, you know, doing the peace sign in front of the Eiffel Tower or whatever people put on
That's
Tinder.
A bit out of date, isn't
yeah,
it?
Exactly. That's and so people are more doing themselves, doing, you know, like windsurfing in some really impressive way, or bungee jumping, or just things that you would kind of send your friends on Snapchat. That's what they've done. It's really working well.
So the third business I'm going to ask you about before we get into how all this works from your point of view on your site was called Lottie, which is the other end of life.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all about care homes, I saw, and how to choose a care home. That looked pretty interesting because, you know, I think lots of people, you know, with older parents would be thinking, how do I go about that? And it seemed to be delivering that offer in a new way again. Explain what Lottie is and does.
Yeah, it's funny that the companies people decide to, people's eyes are drawn to within the website. And so clearly you like the pink, pink
logo.
I think that's probably what drew you to it. They've built both a marketplace to find a care home for your loved ones. They're mostly targeting actually the children of the old people, because the old people don't usually...
They don't want to go to care homes.
They don't want to go to care homes, and they also don't want to search on Google to find the best one. But it's basically a marketplace to help you find the best one for your parents. And they also have... That's how they started. They've now built a software as a service platform for the care homes to manage their operations internally and to manage billing and all this kind of stuff. But again, it's a great team of people who've... And they've raised now, I think... You know, we did their seed round. They've now raised about $35 million or something like that.
So is it an advertising business model or a subscription business model, do you know?
Yeah, it's a cross between the two. They have basically an affiliate, effectively what is structured. Yeah. It's actually a bit more complicated for regulatory and legal in healthcare reasons and stuff, but basically it's an affiliate model on the one side, which is a marketplace where they get effectively, they've managed to monetize some of the leads that they send to care homes. And then they also have a product for the care homes where they charge a subscription monthly for use of their, you know, care software.
It looked really easy to, you know, see where these places were, what they were like, and importantly, what they cost per week, per month or whatever. And I thought that was really helpful.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed going for a browse around your site.
Yeah, well, that's the good thing about consumer is that it's very much...
Everyone feels, I might try this. Or
Whereas if you're a kind of infrastructure tools, you know, developer tools, AI company... you probably yeah. would, and you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't necessarily understand the words on the website and what they mean. Or you might, but others wouldn't.
That's kind of you to say that, maybe not. But I think what's great is you can see these businesses. So why did you decide to go into this space? How did your business journey begin?
So we started as an investment club.
We is who?
So Creative Ventures started as an investment club. So in 2019, I was working at a job in private equity doing consumer and tech investments at a firm called Bridgepoint. And I previously worked in various startups.
Firm.
Very big firm. It's 60 billion AUM. It's a great place, and they've had great track record in like large
AUM.
Capital.
You mean assets under
assets
management.
Under management.
So they've invested $60 billion.
They managed 60 billion. So it's a huge firm. So yeah, I was doing consumer and technology investing there, but I had previously worked in startups and had that kind of early stage passion. So I was actually doing, as many people who work in finance and other jobs, I was doing some angel investing on the side. But the way I was doing it was with my co-founder and now co-founder at the time, just investment buddy.
Yeah.
His name's Casper Lee, who's my cousin. He was originally a YouTuber.
He was quite a successful YouTuber.
Very successful YouTuber. Yeah. But he's also a great entrepreneur. He co-founded a company called Influencer.com,
right.
which is a big business now. I mean, they've got about 150 employees.
Right.
Tens of millions of dollars in revenue, very profitable. It's a big...
So they help people become influencers?
They've helped big enterprise brands...
Find influencers
and pay them.
So they're like an agency for
Yeah, there's a tech-enabled agency, basically. So he had the founder thing, he had the creator thing, and we get on really well. And so we started investing together in startups. And we created an investment club in 2019 where other people could invest with us as well. A lot of people respect Casper and... thought he has a lot of friends who are also creators, and they've respected the business journey he's been on, and so they wanted to get exposure to some of the companies he was investing in with me. And we started investing in startups.
So is he older or younger than you?
He's 2 years younger than me.
So because I noticed you're the general manager, or is that right?
Yeah. Well, he's got lots of different other things as well. So he's got influencers.
Oh, so you're full time on this, and
I'm full time on this, and he has other things as well. Exactly, which actually works really well for us because he's right on the pulse with what's happening in the influencer world. He also has a management company called MVE, which is co-owned by WME, big agency group. So he's got he's got lots of different things going on. So that can often help our founders with what's like on the pulse
keeps
with
you
marketing.
Connected,
so. Exactly, keeps us connected. So we started that in 2019, did that for 3 years. Luckily, got some good results in there, and a couple of our companies sold, and things have gone well with that. And so that allowed us to raise our fund one, which we raised at the end of 21. We actually started investing and closed at the beginning of 2022. So we raised our fund one at a time when there was an incredible surge of excitement to invest in venture capital. We raised our fund, I don't know, likely unconnected, but then the whole market completely
that
crashed.
There was a bit of a change in the mood.
Yeah, there was a real change in the mood. It wasn't our fault, but they just happened to coincide.
Nothing
to
do with you, Sash. No, I accept that.
Yeah. So basically,
so then what happened?
So then we started investing when it was much more of a trough. So we got very lucky with the timing. We've invested in some amazing companies you mentioned, but also a company called Beehive, another company which has done very well, another company called 11 Labs and Practica, and various others that have really kind of done super well and raised lots of money and stuff. And so that, we were showing that we kind of could sustainably create returns. We had a couple of exits. And so that was the track record we used to raise our fund two, which is a $45 million fund. So that's kind of like where we're at in the journey so far.
So I have to ask you this. You said we've known each other a while. I know that because you grew up in our neighborhood. But now you've moved to America. Your first fund you raised here, your second one, it sounds like you moved to America. I mean, this is what we call the brain drain, isn't it, in England? I mean, so why did you go to America? What were you not getting here that made you think, I want to go there?
Yeah, so I have a joke that pretty much all of my friends who are about my age are either in London, are either moving to New York or having a baby. And I haven't had a baby yet, so I guess I had to do the New York move. But no, the brain drain thing is, I think there is something happening. A lot of people have talked about the tax stuff and the non-dom stuff, and that's all happening. I'm sure of it. It's not something that I'm an expert in. Obviously, I think that's more what's happening for the more older people who've already made lots of money. So I really don't know much about that, but I understand that it's also happening for my generation of people who aren't non-doms and don't have to worry too much about their tax bills yet. Most people sort of under the age of 40. I do think a lot of people are moving to the US, especially entrepreneurs, because in many cases there is a greater entrepreneurial energy in the United States. It's there's often more talent. You can hire talent more easily who have worked in great startups before. There is a great scene in London, but maybe there's not quite the same depth of talent who've kind of seen the journey before. I think that obviously investment is often easier to get in the US. And you're kind of just surrounded by people all the time who are like, you know, more ambitious and driven. And I don't want to make this an anti-UK thing.
No, I'm trying to, I was hoping by sharing some of your thoughts, you might help us in the UK become, you know, more attractive.
Not that,
I don't feel you're beating up on the UK at all. But these are the things you're looking for as an entrepreneur with a dynamic startup.
Yeah, and I do think
we could have more of here.
I agree. And I do think the tone has shifted too far against the UK and too far against Europe. I mean, if you go to in America, the Europe is treated like it's kind of like a museum or something, which is obviously not at all the case. So people have taken it way too far. But I do think there are things the UK needs to be doing a bit better to keep up with the US on the entrepreneurship stuff.
Yeah, well, that's interesting to hear.
Well, and the other thing for the UK is the kind of trodden path is to start in the UK, raise your seed round in the UK, then move to the US. And then as soon as you get hit by a massive tax bill because you sold your company, you're long in the US by then. So the UK is almost in this trap where it's getting these companies funded, these amazing entrepreneurs, and educating them and all this kind of stuff. By the time the tax bill hits, 90% of the time they're going to be
paying it in the UK.
Exactly.
So we need to be stickier as a country for entrepreneurs so that we get the benefits of their great success as well, you know, in tax terms.
Yeah.
You've set up in the States now, but just as a thought, if you want to go as a British person to the States, if you're starting a business, you have to employ people, don't you, to be able to move there and become a sort of resident? Is that how it works?
Yeah, well, there's various different types of visas. I mean,
if you have
$5 million, you can get the new golden visa.
You have $5 million.
That's all. Only the $5 million you
and
know.
What do you have to do with the $5 million? Invest it in the US?
No, so this new golden visa where you can give $5 million basically to the US government and you get the right to live in the US and not get taxed on your overseas income, which is pretty incredible. I mean, it's pretty crazy that they've done
it. Really?
Yeah. It's like kind of inspired by these Middle Eastern countries. This is a new policy. But in any case, that's not causing
a Trump era policy.
That's a Trump era policy.
Pay $5 million in tax and then you can live there.
You can live there.
Troubled,
all,
if that's the right word.
Exactly. And apparently it's had a huge inflow. But no, that I think that's not how the entrepreneurs and investors
are
leaving.
Well, that wouldn't draw them necessarily.
No. So I think there's various ways you can move there. You know, you can either sponsor yourself, you can apply for various kind of merit-based visas. There are also investor visas. There's various ways you can do it.
But they are actively encouraging entrepreneurs to come and set up in the States.
Yeah, I mean, they have
been.
The way
they do that.
Yeah, they have been. I don't know what the update is on 2025. I moved before the current administration, but I'm not sure what the latest.
Yeah.
I think even the Republican Party is a little bit divided on that policy.
So you have in your business sort of approach, you have this idea that CEOs can become creators, or you're interested in. Can you explain what you mean? I mean, what sort of opportunities are you looking for in this space?
Well, I mean,
This is actually what it is
CEOs doing podcasts and talking about their business. I mean, you've been doing it before the social media age, things like being in the ads and personalizing the brand. I think as humans, we do like to personalize things. I mean, Reed is a good example of a company that's got the name on the door. And I think that's the reason people have been doing that for, you know, hundreds of years, calling their companies after themselves, because it engages people's minds to think about a human and to personalize it.
This is a person.
Yeah, and I think this is the CEO side is the next layer of this. I mean, what people have started to do is building in public. So, you know, people will be on Twitter and talk about, you know, the revenue this month and why they were behind, and almost treat the social media world almost like it's a board that they're informing about how their business is going. And it works incredibly well when the business is going great. And then
I think I've been around long enough to know it's not always going great.
Yeah. Usually
it's quite painful.
Usually as soon as the numbers go down, they decelerate. Yeah. But
I can imagine that. Yeah.
But yes, I do think that the stuff like the podcasting and things like that, it does help with recruiting, which obviously is your line of work, but it also helps with, you know, investment and all the different bits of running a business. It can help.
I mean, because it's interesting you're saying personalized, you know, someone's name being above the door. That's a long way from sort of AI, it feels a long way from AI, but you're in a way combining or looking for ways to combine the two. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how can we exploit that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, there's a huge opportunity to build companies using AI, both in the product you're selling, but also, you know, in terms of your internal operations and stuff. But I don't think that takes away from how important connecting with the leadership team and, you know, personalizing the company and stuff. You can definitely have both. And if anything, some of these AI companies, you almost need that human trust more. People really care people care about the daily workings of Sam Altman and all this. People are addicted almost to hear. And, you know, the CEO of Perplexity and Anthropic and all these companies, you know, the big enterprise customers are daily tracking what these guys are doing. So I think it's
more than they're living their life entirely in the open, are they? When you say they're tracking what they're doing, I mean,
are they
on sort of Find My Friend? What's going on? Explain.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're all constantly posting on Twitter and LinkedIn and everything like that, the CEOs of those companies. Often those posts are model updates or saying, okay, we've built this new product. And often it's kind of shipping updates to show all the amazing things they've built. But some of them will blend into personal as well.
Right.
So yeah, tech companies are much more forward about the CEOs being creators.
But that's an always on sort of approach that puts a lot of emphasis on the leader, doesn't it?
And
they've got to really sort of be on it. They can't have a down day, can they?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Yeah, it's hard. And yeah, like I say, when the numbers start to move against you, it becomes even more depressing than it otherwise would be, because everybody knows your revenue was X, and when it goes to, you know, X divided by two, that doesn't feel good.
No. And it might have sort of wider ramifications if you've got investors or things.
Yeah.
What the hell's going on here?
Incidentally, podcasts are the best medium for this point, because nobody actually knows how many views your podcast. This is what the very underrated point about podcasts. Nobody knows how many views you get. It's one of the only forms of social media where it's not.
Oh, right.
And there's no way to track it.
Right.
So there's much less shame, which is why people feel more comfortable just starting. Because it's not embarrassing because your friend got more than you or anything like that.
I'm very pleased to say we get quite a good audience.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'd like it to be larger. So
yeah, yeah.
But I think podcasts are very interesting because I enjoy them personally because I'm always learning. I'm learning from every conversation I have.
Yeah.
And you get to sit with someone for an hour and talk to people you wouldn't necessarily get to sit with and talk to for an hour.
Yeah.
And it's a different kind of conversation. Mm. You know, I've done media for years, and if you get interviewed on the radio, you get 3 or 4 questions if you're lucky.
Yeah.
And you've got to make sure you nail your answers to make your point or whatever. This is a more exploratory and I think therefore more interesting medium. Mm. So you know a lot about media. I mean, you just talked because that's where you invest. What's going on in that landscape, you know, at the moment that people should be paying attention to in particular?
I mean, there's so much. It's really blending into the rest of the world. It's really becoming the same. I mean, you can see how even just everything from politics and the tariffs being announced on social media one day, and then the next day it's changed, and it's all happening live on social media. Everything, it's become almost like a form of theater. But from a business perspective, yeah, I mean, there's new stuff every day. There's TikTok's going to be banned, then it's going to be unbanned, and now it's going to be maybe banned again because of China. This is all, you know, this is in the US, but I'm sure there'd be global ramifications too. There's Elon Musk renaming Twitter to X and all that stuff.
Do you see any new sort of channels emerging that you think are big for the future, as TikTok did most recently, I suppose?
Yeah, and definitely yes. I mean, if TikTok is banned in the US, it is going to cause an incredible new emergence of social media companies. If you went in India, TikTok was banned in India in 2020. And, you know, a good chunk of those users just went to Snapchat and Instagram and Facebook and all other places, but a good chunk didn't. And so that made this incredible unlocking of basically screen time for new apps to dominate. So there's a gaming version of TikTok content.
These are all live streaming to Indian
companies. Right. And it's just like the social media landscape is much more distributed in India than anywhere else because of this. So the same thing will definitely happen in the rest of the world.
Interesting, I didn't know. So why did they ban it in India those 5 years ago?
It was because the same reason. It was tensions between India and China.
Oh, they had that incident in the Himalayas, I remember.
And that
was the cause.
That was why they banned it. It was because, they didn't want this Chinese-owned social media app in their country.
Right. And it created a whole new landscape.
It created a whole new landscape, yeah.
So you could see that happening.
Oh, that will definitely happen.
But there is a sense, though, isn't there, that these really dominant social media apps, brands, have crowded out everything else. You know, they're big beasts, aren't they? Instagram and Facebook and X. So is that what we're going to unless the governments get involved and ban things or smash things up, is that how the landscape looks set, do you think? Or do you think it will change?
I think I agree with what you just said. I think the landscape is becoming more and more, apart from if TikTok's banned, which will cause a brief resetting, maybe a decade or so. Generally, the theme is towards more and more concentration in bigger and bigger apps, just because there are network effects.
Yes.
And especially in this TikTok world and the Instagram Reels world, and how, where social media is moving to a feed-based system that's algorithmic, as opposed, so you don't get content from people you follow. Instead, you could get content from anyone in the whole world. That AI basically routes you the right content. There's a huge incumbent advantage from having an extra 100 million
AI
videos.
Knows that I like watching goldfinches and will send me more yes. feeds from birders. Is that what's
and
going
that's
on?
A good example, because it is because it is so niche. And so if you try to start a new social media app, and you got lots about F1 and you are interested in football, but you've got F1 and coffee and whatever, which you're not interested in, and there's nothing about goldfinches, you're going to end up getting more addicted to the one that has the long tail of content about goldfinches.
You use the word addicted. I mean, that's what's going on here, isn't it? They're getting us all hooked.
They are getting us hooked. And like the old form of social media was you would be addicted to, on old YouTube, OG YouTube, you would be very addicted to seeing your favorite YouTuber, and every, Thursday, whenever they uploaded, you get a notification, you would be addicted to that creator. Whereas in this new form of social media, you actually get addicted to the feed itself. You're not actually addicted to a specific creator.
No, you just look at Instagram or whatever because you want to see more videos of whatever.
Exactly. So it's more the feed itself is the addictive part versus the following relationship.
Hence why it's more concentrated.
Yes, and it's also bad for creators, because you'd much rather have an actual loyal audience of your own versus just appear in a feed next to 100 other people. Because the problem with appearing in a feed is, as soon as you become less relevant, or as soon as you stop being quite as good at making addictive algorithmic content, you just drop off and no one even notices.
Yes. So that's a tough environment for creators.
It is, yeah. It's a very tough environment for creators.
So does that mean that they should become CEOs?
Yeah.
What's the story here?
Yeah, so that's the other way, is this, the creators becoming CEOs.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, and that can
I should go back to my day job. Right?
Yeah. So the creators to CEO path can be a really good one. I mean, often it's best when a creator does, and we don't invest in that many companies founded by creators. We invest in a lot of companies where the CEO becomes a creator. Our name, Creator Ventures, actually, just because we're really interested in social media and we think we can help a lot with that. And the creator world is kind of tangential to what we do, but it's not like we invest in companies founded by creators or anything like that. But to the extent that creators do found companies, often it's not necessarily always best for them to be the CEO itself. Sometimes they would be a co-founder that focuses on the growth and the marketing, and you'll have somebody who's like a technologist or somebody who's got a ton of experience building companies before to be the CEO, usually.
So again, that's about creating a good team, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where people play to their different strengths. Now, I happen to know that you worked on establishing Uber quite a long time ago. I think it was in Stoke-on-Trent.
Yeah, it was.
That's right, isn't it, Sasha? Yeah. And I remember thinking how interesting this was, because you went to Stoke-on-Trent, I think, as a relatively young employee. Mm-hmm. Was it Bridgepoint or Uber directly?
It was Uber was first. Uber was very young. Uber joined as the bottom of the hierarchy.
Yeah, so you were sort of foot soldier at Uber.
Exactly.
And they sent you to Stoke-on-Trent and said, get us going there, please, which is good entrepreneurial training. What did you do? What do you have to do? So I want you to share this story. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, so I started at Uber as an operations coordinator in 2015, which is the bottom of the hierarchy. And Stoke-on-Trent was not my first city, because I wasn't trusted at the time to launch a new city. I actually moved to Birmingham. So I had two choices, basically, when I joined Uber. They say, you can either work in the operations team in London and manage a process, for example, drivers onboarding driving license checks, something like that.
But we all know what Uber is now, but people didn't then, did
and
they?
So, yeah, exactly. Well, that was option one. Or option two was move to Birmingham and help them launch the city. And so I chose, and I'd not spent much time outside of London and the areas around it, but I decided to move to Birmingham. And I got really excited by this idea of launching cities. And at the time, after Birmingham, obviously, there were lots more cities to launch. Birmingham is the second biggest city in the UK. And then the final one to launch was Stoke. And the reason I got so passionate about Stoke is because I actually moved there. It was the city I launched myself, hired the team there and everything like that. but also because it was the last city, pretty much it was the last city to launch in the whole UK. Because at the point that we launched Stoke, you know, Stoke's population is not, it's not a huge city, it's 500,000 or something like that.
Yeah, it was one of the smaller places.
So it was quite a symbolic moment when we launched Stoke. It's like, okay, now we've dominated the UK. Yeah. You know, we're not going to go smaller than Stoke.
You had to do Stoke to keep, for sort of pride reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
But the interesting thing, you use the phrase network effect. As I recall, you had to sort of get what were then mini cab drivers and taxi drivers to join Uber. And then you had to get people who would normally ring a minicab firm to use Uber. I mean, they're both networks you have to build. How did you do that? What was the way? What was the strategy? Because anyone starting out in a new venture has that challenge.
Absolutely. So the supply side is the most important for reasons I'll say in a second. But the supply, it's all about getting supply.
So that's the
drivers.
Yeah.
So you've got to... A lot of it is real kind of hustle. You got to, you know, you do something that the old CEO, Travis Kalanick, used to call slanging, which was like kind of, you know, almost drug dealer talk for kind of
for minicab drivers.
Yeah, exactly.
So you had to go to a minicab rank in Stoke.
Exactly.
And do some slanging.
Slanging,
so what did you say?
So slanging.
Well, how did you get away with that?
Yeah, it was a kind of dark arts. It was basically to go into cabs and take cabs places. I mean, obviously you need to take a lot of cabs when you're living in a city if you don't have a car. So you naturally find yourself taking a lot of cabs and you're pitching the driver to join Uber while you're in the minicab.
Right.
That's one form. Or you can just go to the minicab rank and start.
Oh, so you're traveling around. So what was the pitch?
It's because of your point about network effects, it's very hard to convince somebody to join because there's not going to be demand yet.
Well, no one else is in it.
No one else is in it. So the way Uber fixed that, and this is why the launcher job was so interesting, is you had to give people the drivers additional incentives to drive. So you could either give them a trip-based incentive, which is they get additional money for every trip. But at the real beginning, they're probably not going to be any trips. No. And so you have to, you basically pay them by the hour. But you have
so
to
So you
be,
have to pay them by the hour.
But you have to
be available
really careful.
For you.
But yes, but you have to be really careful because there are some times when it's really busy, for example, Friday, Saturday night. Mm. And there are some times when nobody wants to work. Nobody wants to hail a cab, like for example, Thursday afternoon. Problem is, all the drivers want to work Thursday afternoons. If you ask the driver, where would you rather work, Thursday afternoon or Friday night? They're going to tell you Thursday afternoon, but all the business is on Friday night. So you have to really carefully create this incentive structure for drivers to want to drive at the times when it's going to be busy.
You stress supply side because?
Because on the demand side, this is the good thing about being a kind of somewhat well-known brand. The demand side was much easier because you could just get the engineers to look at everybody who's opened the app within that geofence in the last 5 years or basically since it started and email them all on launch day.
Right.
And they'll all open the app. Problem is there'll be no cars. So they'll probably be disappointed because then you don't have that network effect liquidity in the system yet.
We used to give people vouchers and things like that.
Yeah,
they still do
a little bit of that.
Feel but, like I don't use Uber, I get something to try and encourage me to switch it on again, really? Even now.
Yeah. But yeah.
I'm very proud of the fact that I've got a 5-star rating as a passenger.
No,
on Uber.
You don't.
I do.
5.0?
Yeah.
Seriously?
I have. I think that's quite rare.
Okay, so I'll tell you this.
I'm showing off now. Yeah. I'm quite pleased with that.
So this is a fact that not many people know, actually. I don't think it's been talked about much publicly. I actually did this analysis myself when I was working there. The number one reason for people to get low ratings
as passengers is
not being rude or if you are rude or unpleasant, you will get a bad rating. So you've proven that you're not rude or unpleasant.
That's right, not to be.
But the main thing is actually being punctual and not making them wait.
Right.
That is what guarantees a low rating because that's actually their time that you're wasting and therefore their money.
No one likes to have their time wasted.
Yeah, so you clearly
I've worked
are
that
very
out
punctual.
In my life.
Yes.
I try to be. So I like other people to be as well. It's good practice in business.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's interesting. I didn't know that. Thank you for sharing that. Now, the other thing you did is obviously raise these funds. Mm-hmm. I guess you also had to raise some funds to finance your business as a startup. I'm interested in what I might call the pitch question. Mm-hmm. What makes a good pitch? You know, when you go out and present your plans to investors or people who might come into the fund. I mean, I'm just thinking for other entrepreneurs who might want to get some support from others, whether it's friends or family round or whether it's, you know, Series A investment.
Yeah.
What do you think is really important to get right?
Yeah, so it's like, there's a pitching a venture capital fund and there's also pitching a startup to a fund. I mean,
yeah, which one would you like to start with?
Yeah, maybe I'll start with the fund, I'll get the fund over with quickly because that's probably a smaller audience of people who are interested in that.
Yeah.
But I'll just do that quickly. I mean, it really depends on a lot of stuff. It's quite technical. You got to make sure you've got your strategy and your fund size matches your who you are and your background and stuff. It's also very, it depends on getting anchor investors early, and then other investors, maybe family office people that will more follow the more institutional investors who lead it and things like that. But you know, it's not completely different. I think in our fund one, our fund one investors were much less professional. We're more kind of high net worth and family office type people. Our fund two investors are much more institutional, very professional, mostly American investors. In terms of raising from VCs, obviously it's a question I get asked a lot around, like, what's the best way to pitch VCs? And it's hard. It's a bit like asking how to have a good conversation or how to make a friend. It really just depends so much on the context. But I think people can overcomplicate it a lot. I think VCs really just want it, and most investors in companies just want to understand two things. One of them is, how credible are you as a founder? Do you have the skills it takes? Do you have the determination, the drive? Do you, can you bring on people on board? All that kind of stuff. And that's number one. And number two is, how attractive is the market that you're trying to build in? Have there been multiple companies that are the large in it? Is there some reason why now is the moment it's going to take off? And I think just building it around those two.
So the founder and the market, those are the two things.
Those are the two things
you look for first.
Yes, exactly. I mean,
so what do you look for when you say how credible you are as a founder? What gives the founder credibility in your view?
Well, so we have a saying, which is like, we like to invest in companies where the founder seems like he or she was rock chiseled by an almighty power to do exactly that startup. So what we really like is where there's somebody who just has an incredibly clear reason why they are the best person in the entire world to do that
rock
business.
Chiseled, I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. As if like God has
determined this is this person's destiny.
Exactly.
They're going to go and do it. Yes. That's what you look for.
Exactly. So like there's some reason.
Well, what do they do? How do you decide they're rock chiseled? I mean,
so it's basically.
How does one present as rock chiseled? So, I've heard this expression. I want to know how to do it.
So some examples is like, for example, one of our companies, Beehive, is a newsletter company, an email newsletter company.
Yes.
And the entire team had previously built the tech stack behind a company called Morning Brew, which made email software, but they were just one customer. They basically built the tech stack for Morning Brew, but shared it with everybody else, and that was Beehive.
Right.
And so they knew exactly what they needed to do on day one. They could come out the gate with a lot of it ready. And this is true of many of our companies, is people who've come and done something very similar already and know exactly what the plan is. That doesn't always have to be the case. Sometimes you could be a kind of much younger person or a college dropout, something like that, who has incredible, but then in that case, you need to have 10 out of 10 determination or exceptional intelligence, or you need to be a kind of
We've spoken to people on the podcast, entrepreneurs who've come out of school with few qualifications and they've sort of worked their way up and they've shown themselves to be, have those sort of qualities.
And definitely. Usually they will. I'm sure you probably get it out of them when you get to know them, but usually there's remarkable. And by the way, usually even if they're dropouts from school, university, which obviously many of the best founders in history are, usually they've done something in the past, whether even if it's competitive video games or selling magic cards on the weekend or whatever it is, usually they'll have done something entrepreneurial in the past.
Often a series of things I've found. But the other point, the market, I mean, we just discussed sort of AI bird feeders and there was a zero market, you said yourself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but you still went invested in it.
Yeah.
So, but how do you ascertain this is a market of the future?
Yes.
Potentially, as opposed to a market that exists now? Because in a way, they're more interesting, aren't they?
Yes. So the market of the future is exactly what you want. And, it's that analysis of working out not what the current, if you ask a management consultant or investment bank what the current market size, they'll give you a number, which is the amount of people who last year spent money on this thing. What you want is to find out the people who, in 10 years will be spending money on this thing, which is much better calculated by just the number of people that would benefit from this thing and the amount of money they would each be able to pay for it, not the amount of people who are currently buying it or using it, if you see what I mean.
Right. I do. But I mean, that's quite speculative.
That's very speculative. Yeah, that's the game.
That's the risk. That's the risk you take.
Yeah.
But and you've got to try and gauge that. And I suppose the more of this you do and the more experience you gain, the better you'll be.
Well, that's a really funny part of it.
Or is that not the case?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
it's too soon to say.
It's actually, it's really it seems to be really uncorrelated how long you do venture capital for and your return, you know. So obviously, right, there's a lot of confounding variables, but it's actually really funny how little correlation there seems to be between how long you do VC and how well you do.
So what's that tell us?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Nothing good. Nothing good.
Well, it might be. I don't know. Yeah. So it tells us that everyone can have a go in a way.
Yeah, that's true.
So is there anything else that someone pitching for venture capital funds should think about? I mean, in terms of the pitch, I mean, what do you get people to give you formal presentations? If so, how long do they last? What do you expect them to leave behind? That sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I usually schedule a 30-minute call with somebody first, just because I don't want to waste their time or mine. Call. But then obviously we'll go over if it's something that's, you know,
what would you ask them?
I don't have a set question. Some people have set questions, you know, that they ask. And I don't do that at all. The only question I always ask is just like to ask them the story of the business, like how they started, a bit like what you asked me, actually, the story of how they started it. Usually I don't need to ask it because that's the natural thing that usually
they won't tell you that.
So I don't really have any set questions at all. But it's really just understanding this, you know, how they got going and why, the team, the capabilities, that's the way we spent the majority of the call.
So you have 30 minutes. And then after that, you and your partner might chat about it. And then you decide what, you might go and visit them after that, or what's the next step?
Yeah, we'll often meet them in person before, but we don't need to, because, you know, part of our advantage of, you know, being such a small team is we can make decisions extremely quickly, which is obviously much better than a much more institutional firm that takes long to decide. And founders really appreciate early commitments. It's almost to the point where it's the most important factor is how quickly you can decide.
How quickly would you decide on average then?
It can be anything.
That's a competitive advantage you've got.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I mean, it can, you know, the longest, sometimes we'll know founders for years before we actually invest in their company. But in other cases, it will be in the matter of days, or a weekend. Where we can just cram it all in.
So what do you do next in terms of due diligence then?
Yeah, so it would be getting to know them in the first call. Usually that the first call lasts more than 30 minutes if we were really digging, unless somebody has a hard stop or something, usually it'll go on. And then it'll be looking at their backgrounds, trying to do references, you know, on the back door with them, but also looking at their numbers, seeing if there's having early signs of product market fit as well. And just getting to know them better.
But these are businesses that already have customers typically.
It really depends. We can do all customers, or we can do, you know, we can do after customers. It just depends.
So if someone's got an exciting business that they want to pitch to you, how do they find you, Sasha?
I guess LinkedIn. I have my LinkedIn and Twitter DMs are open. Right.
And we'll put your details in the show notes.
Yeah, perfect.
So you're obviously looking, you've got this new fund, which is fantastic. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Who's going to be looking for opportunities to invest in?
That's absolutely right, yeah.
And we want to encourage entrepreneurs. So that's brilliant. You work with your cousin, Casper. Is the fact that he's a cousin important? I mean, quite interesting sort of family dynamics here, because we've had siblings on the podcast, and I've had someone who works with their brother. And is that a good model, do you think?
I think it's fantastic. You know about family business, so you've seen this firsthand, but there's a certain level of trust that you can't screw each other that just makes decisions so much quicker to make, because you're not worried about the other person. Yeah. You're not worrying about not having to have your guard up can just make your entire life so much smoother and easier. And I think that's why family business can be so successful. Yeah, I think at the beginning it was really important, because we created this investment club with other creators in Casper's orbit. And so, but I was running it basically. And so they could tell that I was trustworthy by the fact that I was related to Casper and he trusted me. So that helped them those were basically our first, you know, people investing alongside us. So they almost trusted me because they trusted Casper.
So trust is so important in business in all sorts of ways. But you just said something, it speeds things up, which I find very interesting, because that's my experience as well. I mean, if you don't have to put everything through a team of lawyers,
exactly.
It happens more quickly.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So finding people you trust. So how are you going to do that as you grow? You've got a bigger business. It's going to become bigger again, I'm sure. How are you going to make sure you find colleagues that you trust?
Well, I think we'll definitely remain lean. I don't know we'll remain exactly as lean, but I mean, we have $65 million under management, and it's me full time, Casper's part time, and we have an assistant. who's great.
But how ambitious are you for the amount under management?
Well, the amazing part, the reason I mention that is because there actually is very little to no correlation between how much money you actually manage and how many people you need in the team. I mean, we could scale a lot with our team size. As it happens, we shouldn't scale a lot. But for
you're putting in bigger investments, yeah. I suppose. You can but in Bridgepoint, I must employ quite a few people.
Though. Well, so yeah. So
private equity. That's the other end of the spectrum. Yes. Isn't it? Yeah,
so private equity, you do need more people because you need bodies to, like me, to execute the actual due diligence on the company.
Right.
Whereas my philosophy for venture capital is it's very important for it to be the same person doing the due diligence as making the investment decision. So you know, I'm sure you have. I mean, how many layers does Reed have? How many layers is it?
That's a good question. Six, eight.
Okay, yeah. So every layer of those 6, 8, you know, yeah. The information fidelity, you know, it's very slightly reduces. Oh, yeah. And so you probably want to, you know, it's a massive company, so you need to have enough layers. But the fewer you can have, obviously, the better you can make decisions at the top.
Yes.
And so we have, you know, we've taken that to an extreme where we have zero layers. We just have the people making the decision being the people themselves looking at the company.
So that's a limiting factor in a sense, but it might be your USP, your secret source in a way.
It definitely is, because it means you've
found that so far.
Yeah, for sure. And that's part of
the speed. Do your own diligence if you're going to make an investment. It's your sort of
you have to do
message.
Your own diligence. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because otherwise it's back to trust.
What are the things that you look for that would put you off? Yeah, you know, when you're looking under the bonnet.
I think probably the biggest one is like getting the feeling you can't trust somebody. Back
again,
to trust.
Yes.
But you know, it's like if you feel like somebody's maybe exaggerating, when it's okay to be a bit sales-like, that's often good founders are, but if you get the sense that something's not right.
Enthusiasm goes to too much exaggeration.
Exactly.
That can be a bit off-putting.
Because you know, they are long-term relationships and if you can't really feel like you can truly trust somebody, that's definitely probably the biggest red flag. I think there's, you know, it's so case dependent, but you know, in terms of like a lot of people, one red flag that founders should be careful not to do is they'll throw in like buzzwords that don't necessarily actually relate to their business. It's a tactical point, but actually you'd be shocked by how many people
do it. Why do they do that?
Because they want to be the AI, you know, for example, right now, companies that aren't really that much AI, they'll describe themselves as AI powered.
Oh, right.
Or they'll change their URL to .ai and it's got nothing to do with AI, which, that sounds like a detailed point, but you'd be shocked by an incredible number of people that do that. And it's just a bit of
They're not actually in it, because one of your business, Practica, is a language, is .ai, isn't
yes,
it?
That is AI. So
that is AI-driven language
that's
learning.
That's pure, I mean, you're getting taught English by an avatar.
Right.
So you learn English with an AI
so
avatar.
That makes sense when it's AI to flag it as such.
Yes.
But you're saying don't put AI on if it's just your regular business.
Yes,
is what you're saying.
That people started to
well,
do that.
Well, that goes back to trust again. I mean, it's because it's not AI.
Yeah, that's right.
It's misdescribing something.
And that's just the AI silly example, but there's like people used to do that with, you know, crypto and creators. People just find the thing today that will help
blockchain
them.
Blockchain was a big deal, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Everyone was talking about that at one point.
Yes. Yeah. And so they'll just jump onto the, you know, the current thing and position it as that's what they're interested in. And that's a big red flag.
Right. So you've got to be real.
You've got to be real.
So, I mean, just to sort of probe a little further into AI, because it seems to be this year's big deal.
Yeah.
2025. Everyone seems to be talking about it. You know, how can companies make better use of AI from what you have seen? I mean, because obviously you've seen all these interesting examples. What is there any sort of more general advice you might give businesses who are thinking about, I better do something with AI? What should I do? What should they be looking at?
Yeah, so more and more companies have started writing these memos to their employees about we're an AI first company. First one to do it was Toby from CEO of Shopify, wrote an entire memo to his entire company saying, we are now AI first. Any job, all job offerings will be reviewed, but to see if they can be replaced by AI and then to hire somebody who can be the AI, who can use the AI. And then the CEO of Duolingo came out with the same thing. And more CEOs saying—
So they're just saying to their team, prioritize AI in every way.
Exactly. Prioritize, see what the maximum you can do with AI. And, you know—
And how's that going? What's the result of that?
Well, yeah, we'll see. But it is, I do think a lot of it is just about agency and just trying to think about what you can use AI for, because sometimes you'd be surprised by how much you actually can get done, even just with ChatGPT.
So where does it leave jobs?
Well, so I actually have a view that you're, and it's, I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you, but I believe that this is good for employment. I really do. I genuinely believe
and
that.
And you're not saying that just because you're talking to me.
I promise you I'm
that's
not.
That's very kind of you. Music's my ears. Why do you think
that? No, I do think that because...
It's important. I think jobs are important.
Jobs are definitely important, especially for you. But I think it will actually be good for the job market, because I think what people sometimes forget is that the job market is not a static system. It's a dynamic system. So if one company has AI and can get more leverage out of their employees, then they're going to start doing more with that leverage and building more stuff and becoming more competitive. Their competitor is going to need to do the same thing. So they're going to need to hire more people to actually. So it's like the market for example, web designers.
Mm.
It's become 100 times easier to design a website in the last 20 years. And the market for web designers is 20 times what it's ever been. Mm. It's been making financial models has become quite literally 1,000 times easier than it was and more complicated. But what did that lead to? They made the investment banks just make more complicated financial models and have their people slain away. And so I believe that the leverage that AI gives actually will just make more output per employee. So what do? You hire more employees, it's more output. And so I don't believe people who, and there will be some reshuffling of people. But I think the actual number of raw people hired will not drop at all.
Well, that's been the history of technology up until now.
Yeah,
it seems to have created more jobs.
Yeah.
I think work is important for all sorts of reasons, but particularly our personal well-being, actually. Yeah. So that's good to hear. And we had a guest on the podcast who was talking about the British philosopher Bertrand Russell had a negative view of a factory where new technology was introduced, and he thought they'd either, they'd halve the workforce or make half the people work twice as long. I said, no, they won't. They'll just double output.
Yeah, yeah.
They look quite surprised. They didn't think of this. But that's exactly what you've just said.
Yeah.
That it will make us produce more and become more productive, hopefully.
And actually, that is my biggest fear with it. Of all the fears, I mean, some people are worried about catastrophe and AI taking over. My biggest fear is it's going to result in people working too hard, too much work.
Well, I was thinking some of those CEOs who are always on.
Yes.
Where does it go?
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yes. And even as a CEO or as somebody who's ambitious and pushing hard, there's actually no excuse not to be hacking on some AI thing or work or using AI to somehow improve yourself or get smarter or do your job better. It's become, because now it's work from home as well.
Yes.
So there's no reason why, if you're ambitious, you shouldn't just be permanently working. And that's what leads to a very sad culture where it's 6-day weeks, 7-day weeks, just grinding all the time just to keep up with everybody else. So that's actually my biggest fear.
You think that's a danger? That's interesting.
I think that's the world we're starting to move towards.
That in America?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, more Silicon Valley
companies.
It's not
obvious to me here.
Yeah.
So that might be coming.
Yeah.
It's interesting. But maybe it's different.
I mean, have you heard of 996 in China?
Yes.
Yeah, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. Oh. That type of culture. There's some Silicon Valley companies that have started doing 6-day weeks. They're usually AI companies.
We had a guest who runs a business in Turkey. And so they work 6 days a week in Turkey.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, people here are talking about a 4-day week.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're saying some AI companies in America have moved back to a 6-day week.
6-day week, yeah.
Because, interesting, my father started this company on the 7th of May, 1960, which was a Saturday.
Okay.
We used to work on Saturdays in England. Yeah, so
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was a 6-day or a 5.5-day week in the early 1960s.
That's interesting.
So it's not a given, is it? There's a 5-day week or a 4-day week. Could be a 6-day week.
Yeah.
And that's your concern. I think that would be, I wouldn't want to go to that Chinese system either.
No. We need leisure.
Yeah, no, I think it's important. Well, we need to have a fulfilled life, which includes a lot of different activities.
Yeah.
Some of them work and others related to or beyond it.
Mm.
So thanks for coming in to talk to me, Sasha. Is there anything else you want to say about creative ventures before I ask you my two concluding questions?
It's been great to chat. I think we've covered a lot. And thanks for having me.
I think it's really exciting what you're doing. And I would urge our listeners to have a look at some of those businesses on your site, because they're really interesting. So my first question of the last two is there's a clue on the wall, is what gets you up on a Monday morning?
So you'll know this because, again, we've known each other for a long time, but I'm not a morning person. So I start, I generally work.
Well, you don't get up on a Monday afternoon, do you?
Well, so I...
this would be a UK, first UK for
time,
our podcast.
Yes. UK time, yes.
You're in
New York. I get up predictably about 5 minutes before my first meeting, because I usually have a Zoom meeting, 9 a.m. And so it's a mad dash, you know, 8:55 a.m. to get to the Zoom meeting on time. So actually, my, like, if I give you a literal answer to the question, it's a complete disaster every Monday morning. I'm completely, I feel terrible.
Well, that's but then, very reassuring. Yeah. You can do well and still be in bed at 8:50.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the real answer. That's the literal answer. But the spiritual answer is that I really love what I do. And it is really important. Once you've, you know, had the first 9 a.m. call, you've had a cup of coffee, to really look forward to your week. So yeah, I'm definitely in that category.
A follow-up question, does that mean you go to bed really late? I mean, do you work at night?
So I'm one of those biologically disadvantaged people, and I can tell you're the opposite of this, but I actually need sleep, unfortunately. And it's a real disadvantage. And by the way, there seem to be no evolutionary advantages to compensate for it that anyone can be able to tell.
It's going
to
be good for your brain.
I don't know. Nothing's been proven. I really struggle without getting 8 hours of sleep, which means I still can go to bed at, you know, midnight or so, and it's still tough.
Yeah, well, people are encouraged to sleep healthily, which is 8 hours, so that's good.
Yeah.
So my last question, and it's a question from my interview book, Why You, is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Yeah, so doing the same thing. Our business is a very long-term business. You know, these funds have a life of 10 years. So when we started the fund in 2022, beginning of 2022, we were making a 10-year promise to our investors. So that fund one was a 10-year promise to end in 2032. Right. We've just closed fund two, and that's going to end in 2035. You know, by 5 years' time, we'll probably have a next fund that will have another 10-year life on it. So you're making these incredibly long-term commitments to both your investors and the founders that you're investing in, and obviously your co-founder and everything like that. So my answer is definitely doing the same thing, and I'll be very happy as long as I'm allowed to do it.
So you're in this for the long haul.
Very much so, yeah.
I wish you every success. And I hope you'll come back and talk to me again. And we can see how some of these ideas have developed. That'd be fascinating. Thanks, Sasha. It's been really interesting to talk to you.
Yes, thanks for having me.
All the way from New York. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Sasha, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed, Sasha, or Creative Ventures, all the links are in the show notes. See you next time.